Arguably, the most important thing that's happened in the area of politics in the 20th century has been the continuing rise of nationalism. It's destroyed Western imperialism, the colonial order, and it especially destroyed such systems as Nazism and Bolshevik communism that had international pretensions. It has installed nations everywhere, and one of the major weapons in the armory of nationalism is the concept of a national language.
Michael Holquist of Yale University. He's here to talk about language and national identity. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of language and literature. When we take the measure of political and military hotspots around the globe these days, it's easy to overlook cultural factors such as the language a people speaks. But because there's an almost inevitable relation between language and power, it's important to remember that language is a central component of both politics and military strategy. This is especially so when we attempt to understand how the various forms of nationalism are filling in the gaps where until recently communism dominated in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Listen now for an overview of the connections between language and national identity. You'll hear from Michael Holquist, a professor of comparative literature at Yale University, where he also serves as chair of the Council on Russian and East European Studies. Michael Holquist is the author of books about the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky and the critic Mikhail Bakhtin. Michael Holquist, welcome to the National Humanities Center. We're going to talk about nationalism, identity, and language. Let me begin with this. I have in front of me a dollar bill, and I'm reading from it. Underneath the pyramid with the I at the top, it says, Novus Ordo Seclorum. What does that mean?
Well, it's a pun, actually. The founders of our country were not above making a joke, even in the Great Seal. It is literally a new order of the ages. What it is playing on, of course, is the double meaning that secular has. Seculum in Latin means an age, but it also, in the 18th century, when the country gets founded, is referring to resistance to religion. Mm-hmm. So it's this case that the United States is seen as being not only foundational in that it's a new historical phenomenon, but it's a historical phenomenon not based on religion in the way the old orders were. So that In God We Trust is also part of the American heraldry, but this is the one that's significant for understanding nationalism.
All right, now let me move us back before nationalism. That's a word that we're comfortable with or uncomfortable with in its many manifestations. I'm going to present you with a big order, Michael. What was it? How did the world work before we had this idea of nationalism or nationalisms?
Well, of course, it worked in a number of different ways, but essentially it was an international order in the sense that even in the period immediately preceding the rise of nation states in the 18th century, there was an emphasis on commonality. So that, for instance, in neoclassicism, which is the primary cultural face of Europe in the 18th century, it was possible by imitating ancient classical models, such as Virgil, to write Greek poetry in any language. So that if you did a Virgilian ode in, let us say, Serbian or Russian, it could be just as much of a great ode as one that was written in French or German.
All right. And what happens, for example, to at the highest, most abstract level, what happens to literary expression after nationalism? I take it that it shifts and it takes on a new form of identity.
Well, in order to understand that, you have to go to the political realm, I believe. That is to say that the What happens to literature is very much dependent on what happens to the change in the way governments are organized. Mm-hmm. So that it's the case that in the 18th century, you have the foundation of new kinds of political orders that are based on smaller units, the nation state, beginning especially with France after the French Revolution. No longer empires, but states. Now, this is a real question in political and intellectual history. Why is it that nation state becomes the primary political unit in the 18th century? And it has everything to do with the secular that we began by talking about.
Michael, talk to me for a few minutes about national literary traditions, that is to say, our epics, the things that we look back on our cultural horizons and we identify with as school children and as grown-ups, national literary traditions and the creation of our attitudes toward language.
Well, at the heart of any attempt to understand the relation between national literary traditions and language and power has to be the recognition that the language that is chosen as the national literary language is always a choice. That is to say that
it's not handed down from
it's not
on
handed
high.
Down. It is created among several dialects that were available in France in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. One was chosen to be French, and an academy was established to prosecute the norms of that version of French as opposed to all others.
And it isn't it the story that we are speaking the language that we're speaking today because, what, in the 14th or 15th century in England, one of the dialects that we associate with a writer named Chaucer happened to take a kind of an ascendancy and rose, as it were, to power over other forms of English speech?
That's the case, but it is the kind of power that was then legislated in only later in the 18th century when you start getting, in fact, the rise of nationalism. I mean, it is the dictionary of Johnson and the establishment of the academy in London in the 17th century and in Johnson in the 18th century that lead to a formalized English language. I mean, the difference between being right or wrong. Language is not one thing. It's not a lump. It is always living. It's always growing. It's always various. So that, for instance, in the case of English, we can see that in the United States, there is a great difference, I mean, between the way in which people in the South speak English, the way people in the East speak English. There is no English that is stopped somewhere up in the sky that can be used as a test for which of those is correct or not. And the same is true for identity.
Now, that sounds so commonsensical, Michael Holquist. That's such an appealing argument. How did we get to the point where language was nothing but a kind of monolith, and out of that we would spin our politics and our cultural attitudes?
Well, there are complex historical reasons for this, having to do with centrist ideas about government that therefore needed a centrist language. And so, but we're also talking here about the difference between oral and written language, something we haven't talked about before, but which is absolutely fundamental to understanding the nature of the problem. It is the case that modern nations depend absolutely on written languages. What is problematical about this is that languages are not national in essence. I mean, they have to be declared to be national languages. So that it's the case that in several areas, as in France, it's the case that French was not the national language before the French Revolution.
You told me that there were many languages spoken in France before the Revolution, and the Revolution, this political event brought together, did something to the culture. Now, that's very obvious, but in what way did the politics act on the culture?
Well, in France in 1789, most people did not speak French, or at least 50% of them didn't. I mean, they spoke languages like Occitan, which were then used by the Roman Catholic Church as a way to get to the people. They would use Occident writing as a way to push the ideology of the church.
Michael Holquist, our topic again is nationalism, language, and identity. Here you've been talking about France, both before and after the French Revolution. What about the example of Eastern Europe? You have told me that Russia, for example, is important in this conversation.
Well, Russia is interesting because it presents all possibilities for the relation of nationalism to linguistically defined identity. There is something like a Russian nationalism before the Bolshevik Revolution, which is suppressed in the revolution. We should talk about that perhaps later. But at this point, suffice it that the early version of Russian nationalism that rises in the 19th century is very much in response to events in Germany and the idea that rises in German Romanticism that language is the place where the genius of the folk is to be identified, so that you have the work of the Brothers Grimm in writing dictionaries and in going to the language of the common people, because it's felt that the language of the elites had historically changed, whereas the root of German character, the Volkstum, was to be found in the language of the common people, in not only their language, but their genres. But I mean, what is important is that for the Russians, the nature of the language is that they can go back to a base that is their own in the way that we in English cannot, in America cannot in English. Under the revolution, during the communist period, Russian essentially disappeared as a nationality. It was a super nationality. There were 192 languages spoken in the old Soviet Union, each of which was tied to a particular kind of nationality.
My goodness.
But they all had to know Russian as well. So you could know Chuvash or Ingush, but you also had to know Russian. So that Russian had the status that, in a sense, was supranational and was therefore invisible. There was no Russian identity in the way there was a Chuvash or Ingush identity.
How is it then that the Russians define themselves today after this history, this checkered history of an intermixture between politics and culture and all of these dozens of languages? What is it that defines that people now?
The essential definition of being Russian now has to do with the confusion of finding not only an identity in Europe, but an identity in history. There is an inability to make a connection between the present of Russia and the past of Russia before the revolution. I mean, the revolution is like a great thing stuck in the throat of Russian identity. So that one of the ways in which language is becoming important in Russia today, the Russian language, is in its archaicism, its conscious return to a pre-revolutionary language. Renaming Leningrad, Petersburg is the most obvious example of that, as a way to reconstitute an identity that is injured by the communist interregnum.
All right, now I take it that that would have an analog in the literary history, the expressive cultural history of the Russian people. That is to say, the way they look at writers like, help me with the pronunciation, Michael, Pushkin, Gogol, Dostoevsky, all of these. I mean, those are very malleable kinds of things back there for the Russians.
Well, especially Pushkin, who is the great national poet. And great national poets are another way in which languages serve to anchor identity and nationalism. In order to be a great nation, you must not only have, as we said before, politics, but culture. And the most obvious face of the culture is a great national poet. I mean, Goethe for the Germans, Shakespeare for the English, Dante for the Italians. Pushkin occupies that role for the Russians. And it's important for them, therefore, that he be seen as a European, not just a Russian, but a European poet. The way in which that is a dilemma is best caught is in Dostoevsky's speech on Pushkin, in which he says, Pushkin is a great Russian because he is a great European.
Michael Holquist, again, our topic is nationalism and language and identity. In a way, we've been looking back to one of the great sea changes in world history, that is to say, the intermixture of politics and culture in the 19th century as the great empires declined. What about in our own century? We would look, for example, to what, the period roughly following World War I?
Well, it's in the Treaty of Versailles at the end of the First World War that you see the real power of nationalism emerging as an ideology, because it is under the force of President Wilson's presence that you get the foundation of such new countries as Yugoslavia and mm-hmm. Czechoslovakia and a number of others. So that on the one hand, American Wilsonian democracy, one kind of ideology, sees nationalism as a good thing, something that should be supported as a way to implement the national self-determination of peoples. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, those people who would appear ideologically to be absolutely opposed to Wilsonian ideals,
i.e. the communists,
especially communists such as Lenin mm-hmm. and Stalin, are essentially making the same pitch.
Well, how do they differ then? I mean, if we look back and we're the ones with the white hats and they're the ones with the black hats, how do we make this distinction?
Well, it's a difference in the way in which the power of nationalism is able to cross other kinds of ideology. Nationalism is...
We're talking, for example, about things like class in this instance.
Yes, which was a big problem for the Russians insofar as Lenin had to defend the importance of national identity against class identity in several debates within the party. And he did so in the name of realism. He said, look, these things really, these differences really exist. But it has the peculiarity of being both universal and particular. You cannot be a nationalist as such, although nationalism is everywhere. You cannot be a nationalist as such. You have to be a French nationalist or a German nationalist or a Croatian nationalist. It's a way that you can see the power of nationalism connecting the local identity to something larger. An example of the way language and identity worked in Russia would be, after the revolution, would be the permanent agricultural exhibit in Moscow, where a kind of Disneyland of nations was created, a sort of park where there were divisions for each of the over 100 nationalities mm-hmm. in Russia, each of which...
Bringing them all together.
Bringing them all together in one place. You could see there were walkways that went from Samarkand to Ukraine. And mm-hmm. There would be singers in each, dancers in each, who would be manifesting through their national customs, their national culture, the political dependence on being in the Soviet Union, where they were able to do this.
All right. Now, let me prompt from you a kind of utterly personal example, Michael Holquist, when we speak of language and national identity. You told me a story about when you got married in Germany that illustrates this relationship between these two large forces that may not seem to have much to do with one another. How about it?
Well, I was married in the old Franconian capital of Coburg, and like everybody who gets married there, this was in 1961, by the way, you were still, even after the war, given a book in which you were to record your family history, and it had a place for genealogy. But the most important thing was that it had a list of names that you should name your children. They were things like Wolf Dietrich or Irmentraut or Gisela. These were essentially German names. One of the ways in which the Germans were trying to manifest their identity after the war, when there was a lot of confusion, was through creating a personal connection between German language, German identity, and German names.
Michael Holquist, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation about language and nationalism and identity. We look at very troubled political spots in Eastern Europe now. What comes to mind when you speak not only of politics, but of culture and language?
Well, the most painful and obvious example is the former Yugoslavia, where the Serbs and the Croats formed, before this most recent period, a common language called Serbo-Croatian. which has completely fallen apart. Now Serbs insist on calling their language Serbian, Croatians calling their language Croatian, even though they are mutually intelligible. The way in which this is working itself out is particularly obvious, of course, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, where the difference between the fighting factions is not only is cultural, but fought out in the same languages. But language understood not just as what you speak, I mean, the dialect of you speak, but as it reflects itself in literary tradition, so that the Serbs who are killing the Bosnians do so with music that derives from the songs around the Battle of Kosovo, which happened in the 14th century. I mean, it's an old battle, but it's an epic in which the Serbs feel they find their national identity. So the Serbian literature, Serbian music, Serbian language are very much part of the ideology of forming the Serbian identity right now, which the Bosnians, of course, resist. Another way to say that is that the people who are killing each other in Bosnia speak essentially the same language, whether you call it Serbian or Serbo-Croatian, but that they do so in different contexts. For the Serbs, Serbian is the face of their religion, Serbian Orthodoxy. For the Muslims, it cannot serve that purpose, the language, because they, as Muslims, have Arabic as the language of their religion. So that it's the same language, two completely different cultures.
Michael Holquist, a footnote to our conversation. People listening to this conversation might be saying, well, what does this have to do with me and my life in the United States? We live in what appears to be a unified culture. We speak a single language, although we enjoy many diversities and differences. How does it, for example, come home when we speak of the study of language and what American kids are doing in school?
Well, if we agree that nationalism is the most potent political force in the 20th century, and if we agree that language is an important weapon in the armory of nationalism, then it behooves us to know more about language, not only as a vocabulary, as a syntax, mm-hmm. but to study language in its full cultural implications.
All right, now you're presenting me with a paradox. I mean, if we wanted to be proud and thump the chest and be triumphalist, we could say America is the greatest civilization in the history of the world. And yet the newspapers are full of stories about American students who are woefully ignorant when it comes to foreign languages.
The great danger is that we should fall into the kind of mistake that great empires in the past have made. The Chinese felt that they didn't have to know about the West at the time when Jesuits were translating everything from Chinese culture. The great Islamic civilization at its height felt that they didn't need to know anything about the barbarian West, while the Westerners were translating Quran. It's very important to have knowledge of the other. And we are going to lose that unless we concentrate on studying language in their full cultural dimension. The fact is that the real world is made up of beliefs and emotions, the stuff of culture. And what we in the teaching of study of languages and literature concern ourselves with uh-huh. is precisely emotion and belief, the kind of thing that has an enormous impact on behavior. Ultimately, in future, the nature of international conflict is going to be not between economic systems, not between political ideologies like communism or democracy. It's going to be between culture systems, religion, language, literature, indeed.
What you are telling us, Michael Holquist, is that there is a reason beyond politics and economics to understand how and why languages work.
Well, I'm not sure it's beyond politics or economics. There certainly are very strong political and economic reasons why we should know culture. That is to say, it's important to do business in Japanese, in Japan. Uh-huh. But it's also important to know the culture for the most basic issues having to do with the security interests of the United States. In the old days, there was something called area studies, and it was comprised mostly of social scientists who would tell you what people in the Kremlin, for instance, were thinking. Mm-hmm. The collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 was a complete utter surprise to everybody, and it has caused confusion in area studies.
There was a lot of egg on a lot of faces in
there
Washington.
There still is, yeah. There should be.
Yeah.
The point is that one of the reasons why Kremlinology failed is because it did not take into account the central role of culture mm-hmm. in understanding foreign countries. So that increasingly people who want to know what is going on in, let us say, sensitive spots like Russia, understand that they must know something about what people are feeling and thinking. And the only way to do that is through language and literature.
Michael Holquist is a professor of comparative literature at Yale University, where he also serves as chair of the Council on Russian and East European Studies. Michael Holquist is the author of books about the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky and the critic Mikhail Bakhtin. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll be back with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Michael Holquist of Yale University. Audio cassettes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 771. That's $10, program number 771. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of language and literature. Next week, join me for a conversation and a reading featuring writer Willie Morris and illustrator Barry Mosier. They'll be here to talk about their new book, A Prayer for the Opening of the Little League Season. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Language and National Identity, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation featuring Michael Holquist of Yale University. He says that when we measure political hotspots, it's easy to overlook the importance of cultural factors such as language and its relation to power. Yet language is central to many of the nationalist movements that are replacing the old communist models in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. Language and National Identity, some answers and insights from comparative literature specialist Michael Holquist, this week on Soundings.